So let me welcome you all to the panel on research and teaching. We have a very informed group, 2, 4, 5 people, professors, a dean, etc. I'm going to ask them to introduce themselves in a moment. We're going to have short presentations by each one on the topic, and then we'll open up to questions that can come from the floor. And, of course, we have a set of pre-prepared questions that we'll fall back to. Let's start on the right. Al, do you want to start and introduce yourself, and then we'll just go down the row, and then we'll start having presentations.
Sure. My name is Al Schreier. I'm a professor of physiology, and this year I'm president of the McGill Association of University Teachers.
My name is Martin Grant. I'm the Dean of Science, and I'm a physics professor.
Hi, I'm Darren Barney. I'm a Canada Research Chair in Technology and Citizenship and Associate Professor in the Department of Art History and Communication Studies.
Hi, I'm Jamie McLean. I'm the current president of the Association of McGill University Support Employees.
Hi, my name is Danielle Meadows. I'm a fourth-year graduate student and a counselor for PGSS.
Thank you all very much. Let's start on the right-hand side with Professor Schreier. And Al, if you could speak for, you know, around 3 minutes, perhaps 4, possibly 5 if it's really scintillating.
I'll be sure, John, I promise you. So this topic, I understand, is about research and teaching. And so I thought I'd reflect a little bit about the situation and my experiences and why I think it's so important that we have this combination. I can begin with this morning. So I have an undergraduate student as part of he's an honors student in physiology, and I'm his mentor this year. What that means is I meet with him 4 times in the semester, and we sit and talk about research. And what we really do is we take a research paper or papers, and we go through them. In addition, that student also attends my lab meetings. So this undergraduate student, by virtue of the fact that he's in contact with me and that I'm a researcher and I have a research lab, he gets exposed to learning how to look at science and look at original articles. He gets exposed to the laboratory and what's going on and graduate students presenting information, and a little bit about how science is done well beyond what you'd ever get in the classroom. Now, there's nothing wrong, and it's very important, and of course I teach in the classroom as well, but these kinds of experiences you can't get them otherwise. Now, I'll give you another example. So I happen to co-coordinate the honors seminar course in our department, and it's a group of about 11 students. And these students have to every week they meet a different, or every groups of 3 or 4 weeks they meet different professors, read a couple of research papers, but their assignment at the end of the year is to actually write a research grant. And that's a rather challenging and unique experience, but it's an opportunity that they have, and they have a chance to present it to their colleagues, their other students in the course, and to us. And we review those papers, we give them feedback. And it's an experience that allows them to go from there into other experiences in academia. So there's 2 examples, very practical examples, of how the research and the teaching kind of interface in a very important way. I could go on with other types of things, and maybe I should pass it on, John?
Certainly.
Okay,
thank you very much.
I'm happy to come back after.
So, Martin, can you make a few comments?
Yeah, let me ramble on a bit. It's my view that our best teachers are our best researchers and vice versa. People who are really good teachers, it's informed by the research, and people who are strong researchers, they are tested when they're teaching their undergraduate lectures. This sort of came through to me when I started as dean in 2005. I met this dean from a university in Europe, and we were talking about how to improve our faculties of science. So this person was a faculty of science dean. And so she said she would tell me how she's doing. So I was all ears. So I figured, you know, here's the news that I need to be a successful dean. So she said to me, what I'm going to do in my university, and I won't tell you the name of it because it's webcast, in my university, I'm going to no longer have researchers do teaching. I'm going to have professional teachers do teaching. I will have professional researchers do research, and we will be managed by professional administrators. And, you know, I started this job, and my previous experience had largely been working with grad students and teaching undergraduates, and my first thought was, yes, there's one less university in McGill's way as we move up the rankings. I could tell this person was completely wrong. Like I said, our best teachers, our best researchers, we take a lot of pride in my faculty that our administrators are people who do teaching with their grad students, who've had or have an active research program. It's essential for the quality of our university. It's an essential part of McGill University. There have been a lot of changes in this university since around 2001 because of the huge renewal of excellent academic staff, excellent, exceptional people we've attracted from everywhere in the world to this university. But there's one thing that hasn't changed at this university. We have had the best undergraduate students in the country for 200 years. Simple as that. And we can push off that to where we're going in the future. So what we've done in my faculty and in other faculties is to encourage professors to interact in a meaningful way in undergraduate research with these students. And everybody does it. They're happy they do it because the kids are so smart, they're so driven, and they want to make a difference. The program that we put in place, now I think it's been done, most of the faculties in McGill has been copied by at least a dozen universities in Canada and the Northeast United States, because it's a good idea for the professors and the students. And when I see something that says, you know, teaching versus research, I think, no. They both are together and they're both integrated, and that's how we make ourselves successful as a university. That's something that can be a hallmark of our school.
Thank you very much. Darren.
Thanks very much, John. So I was told I had 10 minutes, and I'm not going to talk for 10 minutes. One of the things I've learned as a Canada research chair is to be obsessively prepared. So I've done that, but I'm going to, you know, scrap it all and I'll stick to five. Yeah, it's very interesting that on the program, the topic of the panel is styled as research versus teaching, because I think it's this versus that strikes fear into the hearts of many of the people in this room, because very few of us like to think, as Dean Grant just said, teaching and research are opposed. The reason I think this matters on the agenda is because last spring in the debate over whether the underfunding of Quebec universities demanded it, tuition fee increase, the point was raised that perhaps the problem is not the lack of funds, but the mismanagement of funds, including, it was insinuated, the direction of massive amounts of money to research that could otherwise go to teaching. The prospect was raised that some sort of council external to the university might look into this with an eye towards demanding adjustment of university spending priorities when it comes to research. And spines shivered, because this goes to the very heart of what the university is for. We all have all kinds of ideas of what the university is for and what it ought to be for. And in many ways, I think opening a serious debate over that, more than just the question of tuition fee increase, is what the student strike was about, opening up a serious debate with consequences about what the university is and what it's for. In my view, the university ought to be a place that is reserved for what I will call free and studious inquiry. Free and studious inquiry, each one of those terms is important, I think. Inquiry means that our practice is oriented toward asking questions about the world and about our living in it together. Studious means that study is the mode in which we do that. Here at the university, we inquire by studying. And free means free of predetermined parameters and ends. It means following the questions where they lead endlessly and for their own sake. So studious inquiry is a kind of end in itself, not a means to some other end. Right? And I think that traverses every discipline that properly belongs to the university, in the arts and the humanities and social sciences and the natural sciences. It's free and studious inquiry, right, in which this false distinction between research and teaching dissolves. Because free and studious inquiry is the name for both together, right? It's the name, the other name for it is simply scholarship, I think. And this is what makes the university exceptional. It's a place where that defines what happens, in our dreams at least, in our dreams. On some days, I think the universities that we work in, and I'm not just talking now about this university, but the university is a more general category, certainly in Canada or North America. You know, on some days, on good days, the university feels like that kind of place, a place of free and studious inquiry. But on many more days, it does not. We're, I think, increasingly less often called to inquire than we are called to innovate, right? Which is to say, to generate solutions rather than to inhabit questions. Patience for study has given way to the imperative to produce outcomes on a serial basis. internal and external incentives convert inquiry into an instrument that serves various social, economic, and technological ends. And under these auspices, all of a sudden the separation of teaching and research becomes a kind of utterable statement that makes sense somehow. All sorts of schemes start to recommend themselves. Perhaps we should have some professors who just do teaching but not research, and some who do research. No, I'm not endorsing that. I'm saying this is the kind of scheme that starts to get floated when we start to think about research and teaching as separate enterprises, right? Maybe we should concentrate money for research in a few elite universities and leave the rest to do just teaching. Maybe we should have a council made up of bureaucrats and politicians and students to review university accounts and decide whether they're spending too much on research rather than on teaching. Maybe support for the university should be contingent on such a council's prior approval and direction of what the university does with its money. Right? Each of these is a nightmare for anyone devoted to the idea that the university is for free and studious inquiry. But what I want to say is that to pretend that such threats are new or that they have been implied uniquely and necessarily by the student strike and its name and its aims, or that the chief and only threat to free and studious inquiry is whatever might arise from the forthcoming summit on higher education, is to kind of bar the door after the house has been robbed. Because the time has long passed, indeed, if any time, every such time ever existed, in which the university could determine its priorities completely free from undue outside influence. The university, in general, again, invites, solicits, and responds to external influence, state and corporate influence, political and economic influence, public and private influence, ideological and technological influence over its scholarly priorities every single day. This has been institutionalized, whether by inclination or by necessity, right? And so if the outcome of this upcoming summit is an effort to direct the way the university organizes its resources vis-a-vis the relationship between research and teaching, we're going to hear all kinds of arguments about academic freedom and university autonomy, but they might ring hollow in light of the fact that this ship has in many ways already sailed and that it was us who christened it. Our arguments might come across not as arguments against the threat of external interference per se, but against particular sources or forms or orientations of external influence. Right? And so I think we need to think about our response to this possible threat, which is, I think, a real threat. Right? All genuine political moments carry a threat with them. You can't guarantee the outcome is going to be a good one. Right? I think we have to think about our response to this possible threat of an attempt to constrain the freedom of studious inquiry by thinking very hard about what our real role, our real position is vis-a-vis external influence on what the university does. Because I think increasingly, as we've kind of conceded to playing a role that's bound up in economic growth and competitiveness, fueling technological innovation, right, with a bit of basic science and basic culture on the side, right, we've become more and more unexceptional as institutions, more like than unlike what goes on elsewhere, not such a special place, and so we've become more rather than less vulnerable to the predations of external influences. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Darren. You did well to condense your 10 minutes in 5.
I just kept all the political stuff out.
Let me introduce Jamie McLean.
Thank you. So I guess I'm coming at this from a fairly different perspective than you three right here. From the perspective of a labor union on campus. So I'm not sure, many of you might not be familiar with the MUSE. It's the Association of McGill University Support Employees. And what this means is that we represent casual non-academic employees on campus. So meaning a lot of part-time and temporary positions. Many of our members are
students who work part-time or over the summers or even almost full-time hours throughout their studies, doing a variety of jobs. But then we also have members who are doing temporary assignments. So this might be on a project that's grant-based, doing clerical or technical work, and a whole host of possibilities. We have about 1,400 members across both campuses in almost any building or department. You could find one of our members, often working in similar jobs alongside UNACA members who are also support employees in permanent positions. So I guess I'm coming from this as from the perspective of the university as a place for teaching and learning and research, but also it's a workplace. So a couple of the different aspects of that are that there are students who are learning as undergrads or as graduate students, who are also working here, whether it's in an administrative job or maybe in a job on a research project, or even in a lab doing maintenance in a science lab, doing more technical things in a research project that's not, the role of a research assistant or a research associate. So I guess one of the things that we see coming up is the idea that I guess students working on campus, people working on campus, do value this role of contributing towards teaching and learning and research in the university, sometimes above their own working conditions. There might be students doing projects that they value more than, their wages or other aspects of their job. So that's something that comes up time and time again. And I guess when we're considering teaching and research, it's also the funds of where does that come from. And I suppose that one of the fears of labor unions at a university is that they'll, limit the ways that money is spent or limit the ways that hiring is done, when really the priority is just to maintain that the university space remains a happy, healthy, safe workplace for the members. So I think I'll stop there and pass it on.
Thank you very much. Let me introduce Danielle Meadow.
Danielle Meadows.
Meadows.
I'd like to echo the sentiments of my fellow panelists in that one of the unique things about being at a university that is very research intensive is this multi-level of education that we experience as students. Our education isn't simply what we learn sitting in a classroom. It's also what we learn working at a benchtop with people who've been doing the things that you're learning for many years longer than you. And, you can walk down the hall and ask them these questions of, well, this isn't working. What do you suggest? How can I possibly try to fix this? And in the process, you're learning how to troubleshoot for yourself later on. And you also get a lot of collaboration and discussion. And these are all methods of learning that don't exist in a classroom. So to separate research and teaching into two separate entities, I think, it's short-sighted. It's not looking at the big picture and looking at what you can take from this. One of the things that I do question, though, is the idea that maybe the best researchers are the best teachers. I sometimes take a bit of a problem with that because, at least in my experience, teaching is a skill that is learned, not something that is innate. And so, just because you're really good at science and research and formulating ideas, it doesn't mean you're very skilled at getting those ideas across to other people. So in my experience as a student, that's one of the areas that we really should be going forward with, because we could very much gain more from having some of our researchers who are doing this great cutting-edge research be able to present it and break it down, especially at the student level.
Thank you, Danielle. Martin, do you want to have a quick comeback?
The last thing is that it's really interesting the way this works itself out. So professors come here after they do a postdoc or their PhD or whatever, and what happens is they get in front of a classroom the first time, and I swear that at those lectures, sometimes the students learn something when a professor is teaching the first time, but the professor always learns something. Because you never get smarter than you are when you're 19. And if you're teaching a bunch of 19-year-olds, they're not interested in hearing the fact that you did a postdoc at Harvard or you're this really bright guy. You have to explain everything inside the course, and it sharpens people up very quickly to start teaching. It is like being thrown in the deep end of the pool.
So we have a moment to open up to questions, but let me use the privilege of the chair to make a few remarks on the topic. We haven't had anybody here who has voiced the view that's out there, which is that somehow funding problems would be solved if only we would focus on teaching and that somehow the quality of education would improve. I think that's a sort of straw man that perhaps we're addressing. I'd like to comment on instances where you have had a dramatic and a categorical distinction between teaching and research. France would be one. Germany would be another. Where you have the CNRS in France, you basically have a set of top-line researchers who are paid to do that, and they establish laboratories. And then you have people who have line positions in universities who are lecturers. It doesn't mean that the people in CNRS doing research don't have any connection with teaching. They do. And it doesn't mean that the lecturers don't have opportunities to do research. But these are still different enterprises. And what it ends up doing, in my estimation, is essentially packing all the students in with a set of profs, so they have much less opportunity to have access to those teachers and professors. And essentially, it does estrange the students from the research enterprise that goes on, except the graduate students, in CNRS. And so it, in a sense, impoverishes both sides. And I would think if I was a student, I'd like to ask myself, do I want a teacher at this level who would be more like my excellent high school and SageUp teachers, who basically are teaching with imagination material that they've derived from somewhere else, or do I want to study with a prof who is actually doing cutting-edge work in the particular field, and together we create something really, really interesting and important. And I think that's the model that we're trying to emulate at McGill, and I think it's a more broad-based approach in North America, and I think it has much merit.
Can I respond to that, John?
Yes, sure.
So I think that's I agree with you, and I would add only that what we have to get to is that if that is what we believe here at McGill, and if that's what we want for this university, because we believe in it in a principled way, as you just expressed it, then we have to believe that it's also good for Peterborough and for St. Catharines and for Prince George and for all the universities in Canada. That's a value that we should try to achieve across the university system as a whole, and not just here. And I'm not saying that you were suggesting otherwise, but I think it's really important that we continue to say that if that's what we believe in, that we have to believe in it for everyone, and we have to think creatively, not just about how we can preserve that wonderful combination that we've established here, but how we can extend and sustain it elsewhere and kind of assume a leadership position in doing that, and certainly not advocate for going in the other direction. And I think that in many ways, that might be what the student movement is actually about as well, not separating research and teaching and trying to kind of beggar research in favor of teaching, but in fact to generalize and universalize exactly the kind of experience that you just described.
Well, I think, you know, voicing these sorts of views is very, very important, because at least in the student discourse that we've heard over the last, say, 8 months, this viewpoint hasn't been given very much voice, and the idea that, in fact, one, you've got a finite pie, and the more research you have, the less good teaching you have, it seems to be out there, and I think it's absolutely wrong. Martin, do you want to...
Yeah, I just wanted to reinforce your point, John. Before I came to me, I was working at Bell Labs, and it was a very good research place. People routinely left at 30. because you can't really keep on going unless you go back to the source of the waters, which is working with students. That's why university professors stay active in research for a long period of time. You can look at these things like institutes of theoretical physics. They're set up all over the place, and they're hugely underperforming because they don't have any students. So people sit around talking to their navels, talking, so what do you think is important, Darren? What should I be working on? They talk about nothing because they're never going back to the 19-year-olds who are smart and push back at them. That's the advantage here. And we hobble ourselves. We think it's a disadvantage if we try to separate the two.
Al.
Just to follow up your point, John, so I spent a year at an INSERM institute in France. That's the medical side of the research. And it was a shocker for me in a sense that, as opposed to here, there's very few graduate students. In fact, it was mostly postdoctoral fellows that were there. And because of the separation of between the institutions where they had to get educated, this is the University of Paris, so there was the professors who taught in the university, or the professor who taught in the university, and then those that did the research in the INSERM. And this divide was quite striking. And it's also the culture, because here at McGill, of course, we have graduate students. We just had a discussion about student numbers, trying to increase student numbers and graduate student numbers. And how that spills over is that those students then interact with the undergraduate student and build a culture of research. I think it's part of the entire environment. That's why I think it's so important.
So let's open to the floor. And oh, there's somebody there at the microphone.
Yes, yes.
Ken, please.
Prepared for this. I guess I have two comments. First of all, to support very much what Derek Barney said about the commoditization, if you like, of what we do can tend to divide research and teaching. So in other words, if research and teaching are products, they can be separately marketed, separately sold. They're separately available. So that's a danger to identify that the university is producing a product. Is the product research, teaching? This will be divisive in the end. And the second point is to come back to what Dr. Grant said about the best teachers are the best researchers. And that might be true, but I think we have to value teaching. We have to value research. And, for example, I would not recommend that since your best teachers are your best researchers are your best teachers, that you measure faculty contribution by just one of those parameters, say research, since they're the same. You're measuring the same thing. Why don't we just determine, you know, why don't we just evaluate on the basis of the one that's easiest to measure, research perhaps. So,
well, I said it like three or four times, so I'll say it again, why not? So, but the best people are able to do both. And working with students keeps you sharp. And if you're not sharp, if you're not doing research, the students rip you to shreds. Everybody knows this who teaches at McGill because the students are so good here. And yeah, it is routine that people are evaluated on both their teaching and on their research. I think it's true at all faculties, but I'm proud of the fact that in science, we have these teaching awards that we give out every year. And of the teaching awards for the last 7 or 8 years, every single person who's won these awards is a strong researcher. And I think one or two of them are academic administrators on top of that. You know? It's something, so not only do I say I take pride, not only do I take pride in that, I say I take pride in that in all occasions that I have when I speak. To say the faculty, this is something important to the faculty of science, I presume important to McGill, and claim it as a virtue. If we claim it as a virtue, then it's ours.
Let me ask the speakers to introduce themselves as they're beginning to pose their question.
Okay, my name is Errol Solomon. I'm the External Affairs Officer of the PGSS and one of the organizers of this event. I have a question regarding support staff. So we seem to mostly be talking about research versus teaching or research and teaching, but I'm wondering what role support staff should play in the university. And Jamie provided some introductory remarks, but I'm wondering what the other speakers would have to say in that regard.
As a graduate student, I rely on the know-how of the support staff in my lab every day. If I don't know how to do something, the support staff in my lab is the first person I'm going to go to ask the question. So in terms of how valuable they are, they're invaluable because it's really on their backbone that a lot of the research is happening because they have the technical know-how sitting at the bench to help guide the students who are doing the research and who are we're doing the work on the bench, they're guiding their hands. So in my opinion, they're invaluable.
Any comments from the other members of the panel?
I would agree. You know, if I stick to my own category, free and studious inquiry, the greatest resource necessary for that is time, and time at the university is, I think, a function of a well-trained, committed, and well-populated support staff. And I think we've, you know, that support staff is one of the places in which it's sometimes easiest to enact attrition or to enact certain kinds of perceived technological replacement for what support staff accomplishes. And I think at almost every turn that comes with a kind of temporal deficit that undermines the scholarly experience for both faculty and students. And so we really need to understand an ongoing investment in the number and quality of support staff as a condition of possibility of scholarship at the university for both students and faculty members.
Okay, Al, and then Martin.
So just to echo the comment, because at the research level anyways, the support staff that we have are our partners. So we work closely together with them, and it's very true that the support staff works with the students and in many cases do the mentoring as well. So they're really a part of the fabric. The other side, of course, is from the teaching side, where the support staff are also critical. And this is a real demand, and I think it's an area that we really have to support. It's being challenged, because we're being challenged by the government to reduce the amount of support staff, which puts an increased burden upon them, which makes it more difficult for them to play the roles. And I think that's a big challenge for us in the years coming ahead.
Martin.
Just quickly. What we do at a university is, literally speaking, is we do teaching research to improve young people's lives for the better. It's nothing more complicated than that. It's as simple as that. And for me, anyway, there are many lessons we can learn from that miserable Munaka strike we had about a year ago. And one lesson, I think, is that when I talk to people who are on the picket lines, a lot of their concern was, are students able to get their labs done? Are students able to graduate? And when I talk to people who are in the, you know, the offices, who are doing extra work, working themselves down, they were working themselves, you know, sometimes literally into bad health. And the reason they're doing it is not because, you know, they had such a wonderful dean or, you know, such a wonderful this person or that person. Their only concern actually was that students would get their degrees and they would be able to go to their conferences and get their PhDs and BAs and BSCs. That's the quality of support staff we have here.
Thank you. Do you want to follow on that or any other questions or comments from the floor? We have a number of other questions we may want to turn to, which inform this panel. I think some of them have already been addressed, like should all professors who teach research, should all professors who research teach? I think there's a consensus here that, yes, they should. What about publish or perish? It says publish or perish is the mentality among young professors. Are we not valuing the importance of teaching in the hiring of professors and the decisions about tenure? I think the premise of the question is, are we undervaluing teaching in that regard? I think we've addressed it, but maybe, I don't know, Martin, you see many people coming through for tenure. Do you want to pick up
you look at the teaching, of course, for tenure, it's really important. Whether it's a graduate student thing, it's the undergraduate student evaluations. I don't know if it seems everybody's a prof here or something, but all the undergraduates fill out these teaching evaluations, you know? It makes a big deal for someone who gets tenure or not get tenure, actually.
Okay, so let me focus on the first question, which actually addresses a point that Darren had picked up and developed. What are some of the different needs between research-intensive and teaching-intensive universities, and how should their operating budgets reflect these differences? So my remarks were basically saying the best teaching occurs when it's it's involved in somehow the substance that teachers and students interact over is cutting-edge issues and research. The two things are blended together. Darren has said, essentially, isn't this a value that should be spread across all the universities of different sorts? And, of course, we have large universities, small universities, colleges, et cetera. And the implication of his remarks is that there shouldn't be research-intensive or teaching-intensive institutions. All institutions should be doing both. So that seems to me to be an interesting and provocative take on it. The notion of research intensivity implies that you have a continuum, and there are some institutions that are really much more research intensive, and they have to both acquire resources from the outside and invest them. Does anybody want to pick up on that that issue?
I'll do it on top.
Why not?
I don't know why I came. I didn't want to come. Jeez. So it's interesting. They all do. We should all do research. You're absolutely right. But the way we express that might be different. Look at sort of a gold standard undergraduate Canadian school, St. Francis Xavier. It's very routine that they're involving all their undergraduates in research or field experience before they graduate. So there are different ways you might express it at a university like us than you might express it at Bishop's, or you might express it somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. I don't necessarily think one size fits all in terms of the manner in which the combination of research and teaching is expressed at different institutions in different locations with different kinds of student populations. My suggestion was merely that if, in fact, we believe what we say about the kind of deep and intrinsic value of the educational experience of an environment in which serious attention to research is combined with serious attention to teaching, it's incoherent to then also adopt a position that says that precious experience is going to be reserved for a concentrated few institutions, while there's going to be a whole other range of institutions that are going to be structurally denied access to that same experience. That doesn't mean that the way the combination of research and teaching expresses itself at different institutions has to be identical. It means that the value has to be applied across those settings.
Just to comment back on that. So I attended recently the meeting of the Canadian Association of University Teachers, and what's striking is that the majority of institutions are not research-oriented. And that's partly because they're smaller institutions, because they haven't got the infrastructure, and it's not part of the culture or the support system of the university. So taking on that challenge would mean reframing the institutions, supporting them differently, and changing the culture. That's a big challenge. It's a worthwhile challenge, but it's a big challenge.
I guess one of the things that I would question with that idea, not that I fully disagree with it, because I think it's a valid point, but I guess my question is when we're dealing with very finite resources, how can we bring research to all of these other universities who have none of the infrastructure to really be able to do a lot of the cutting edge research? What do you do about distribution of finite resources? Because there's only so much money that you can give to research. And
yeah, I mean, distribution is the crucial question. And one answer to the question of how you distribute finite resources is to concentrate those resources in specialist institutions. I'm just not sure that's the only answer. I mean, I haven't got a formula for you that will say this is how we make sure that the research experience at the University of Quebec at Chicoutimi, where one of my own PhDs just went, fantastic researcher, I assure he's going to be a fantastic teacher, and he's there now trying under those conditions to replicate the kind of experience that he had here at McGill in that setting, which is a great challenge, partly because resources aren't necessarily in place for that kind of endeavor. You know, I don't know what the formula is, but I think what we have to consider and kind of think seriously about is whether concentration and stratification is an adequate response to the difficult situation that you've just sketched.
Let me just interject. One way to get around the problem of categorizing institutions as different sorts of institutions is that most research money is given out to individuals or to research groups. So in that sense, there's an opportunity for people across all the institutions to sort of get in the game and have an effect on their own institutions in that way. Ken.
Although John Back, Ken Hastings, president-elect of MAUT. How does research-intensive versus teaching-intensive appear in terms of the internal budget? What are the financial implications and the differences? And I guess I never really thought too much about it, but it seems to me clearly there are two elements, and those who are engaged more might correct me if I'm wrong. One of them is that the reality is that most research is funded by external grants from outside. So in principle, if that was all that was involved, there would be no impact on the university's internal budget. Okay. However, there's what we would consider to be the indirect costs. Okay, and this is a major issue in Canada and at McGill. But so that's one element is the indirect cost, what the university has to pay to just keep research running. But the other side is the number of professors that you need. I'm imagining that for a given number of students to go through, a research-intensive university must have more professors. And I don't know if that's a fact, but it would seem to me that if your professors are doing a lot of research, they're doing less teaching. If you're going to teach the same number of students, you need more professors. And if that's the case, then the cost of the university, and it's the universities that are paying by and large, there is some salary support from outside, but over the lifetime of researchers, the universities are big payers to the research faculty. So I'm wondering if those are the two really it, or is there a third major element that would distinguish a teaching university from a research university in terms of the funding requirement? And I don't know if that covers it. If that does, those are the two issues then that would distinguish them. And if the people that are supporting the universities want research-intensive universities, they'd have to be willing to accept that there will be more professors per student, and that there are indirect costs associated with that.
I mean, there are technical definitions of research intensivity, which are just simply numbers, the relationship between number of profs and the amount of research dollars that come in, and that establishes a hierarchy. So maybe just the overall research funding would be part of that, distinguishing between the two. But there, across the university, there's a lot of diversity. I rather think some prof who happened to be up in the neuro in the medical faculty might find the whole balance between teaching research very different than down in, I don't know, where Darren is in the Faculty of Arts. And so, you know, I think those differences occur, and there isn't just one pattern. Let me make one more comment. I think we have a few minutes. I sent two sons to small, excellent liberal arts colleges. And that, of course, provides a sort of quality of education where the lack of heavy research support is tempered by the fact that you have very intimate linkages between profs and students, and they work together, and they're very small classes, et cetera. But when I took one of my sons to one of these colleges, I'll not mention it for... The introduction was, we are teaching-centric, we value our teaching so much that when our teachers come up for tenure review, we don't even count their research. I was appalled, and I put my hand up and I said, is that really what you want? You want to give a disincentive for people carrying out research? And of course, there were many, many people carrying out research and publishing books, etc. But that was that was quite striking. I'm not sure that would necessarily follow from most excellent teaching liberal arts colleges. Any other questions or comments? Yes, please come to the microphone and tell us who you are.
I'm Dick Harris. I'm retired professor of physics. And I don't think I disagree with anything that I've heard, but I would like to sort of sharpen the question a little bit in the following way. At McGill, we believe that because we have many, many excellent cutting-edge researchers and excellent undergraduates, we believe that somehow there's a synergy that happens. I mean, Martin has talked about it. And yet, I think if we actually examine what's going on, there are a lot of undergraduate students who go through this place who don't really get the feeling that the research that's done has got anything whatever to do with them. And I think that's unfortunate. I believe it to be true. So I'd like to hear from some of the panelists of some of the ways in which they feel perhaps that we could give that experience to more of our undergraduate students. I know there are initiatives in science that Martin has introduced.
This is a softball for
Alice talked about some of the things that he does, but do they reach all of our students? I'm not so sure. And if they don't, then what is it that we can do about it?
Comments from the panel. Martin, this is sort of a softball for you, isn't it?
Yeah. We did tons of things. I get tired of talking about it, actually. It was started by Morton when Morton was associate dean in Morton Mendelsohn. He's associate dean in science. So we started an undergraduate research conference. We have elective undergraduate research courses. We have biannual soup and science thing, which is a lot of fun, actually, where we meet the new professors who have been hired over the course of a week. And there's a huge number of things. All the honors courses now in science anyway, I don't know about the other faculties, have a mandatory research involvement with it. We have freshman interest groups for the freshmen. We have graduate interest groups for the graduate student, for the students who are graduating. I think it's not rocket science, but I think it's a little bit of recognizing what we've already been doing in the university to taking, making it and saying something we value. I had this... I have these icky files I have to deal with all the time, and I was comparing files for tenure from recently for one 20 years ago. And one thing really struck me about it, so the faculty has taken it, you know, to heart that it's a great idea to work with the undergraduates because they're really smart, we can get further, they'll get further, we'll get further. And when I looked at the file from 20 years ago, it looked like the file now, nothing about undergraduate research, not a word. Some things about undergraduate teaching evaluations and graduate students, nothing about undergrad research. I look at the files that come up for tenure right now in the Faculty of Science, and I presume the other faculties, they all list their involvement with undergraduates in the undergraduate research program. It's a solved problem, and that's why it's been copied by other universities and by other faculties within our university.
Al.
So just to go on with that, a number of years ago, we started having an annual research day, and these are for the students that were participating in the honors honors research course. And so, when you do the research course, you have to do a research project, and at the end of the year, you have a chance to present that at the research day, which, by the way, was sponsored by the Undergraduate Student Association in our department, and it involves bringing in an external speaker and showing them around and having an event. It's a small thing, relatively speaking, and I really am sensitive to the comment about trying to spread this out amongst many of our students. I think it's true. I think a lot of students go through the program because the classes are large and the programs are big, and they don't really get the chance to necessarily be exposed as much as they could be. I mean, so one of the things we try and do is have an opportunity for them to come and tour around. So whether it's, you know, we invite some of them to come around and visit the labs, or we auction ourselves off at events or things like this to get some exposure. But it's a real challenge because, you know, we have big demands upon ourselves from the research side, and trying to make time to work with a large population of students is very, very challenging. And so I think it's something that we have to take care of, and we don't do it quite well enough yet.
Thank you, Al. Darren.
I'll just add to that. from the perspective of professor in the Faculty of Arts or Humanities, we've been trying as well, as you know, to integrate more opportunities for undergraduate research in the undergraduate experience. I myself have participated in research internship programs with great reward for me as a researcher, and I hope also for the students. I think there's several ways in which in the Faculty of Arts and the kind of teaching that we do in arts and humanities, there are some easy ways in which we can kind of bring research to the undergraduate experience, which is to bring the research that we're doing into our classrooms in a systematic way to kind of excite them. The other way, of course, is to make increased research demands of our students as a part of their coursework and their education. And the third is to involve undergraduate students in our research projects as interns or as assistants. So all of that can be done, and people are doing it. What we come up against, of course, is precisely this problem of scale and resources. Because to actually provide a rewarding research experience for undergraduates takes considerable time and attention, and that means lower ratios. The word ratio came up in the last class between the researchers and students, so that the kind of care and attention that needs to be devoted, in fact, to kind of cultivate the disposition and practices and techniques of research in a student can actually be taken. And that goes to, I think, and these again are problems that in some cases there are technological fixes to them, but largely I don't think they can be solved by technology. I think what they require are professorial bodies in classrooms and, crucially, teaching assistant bodies in classrooms. And I think one of the ways in which we can really enhance the research experience of undergraduates in the arts and humanities is to devote increasing teaching assistant resources to those courses, whereby in smaller groups, senior researchers in training, PhD students, master's students, can then have the experience of passing on that research experience to undergraduates.
Thank you, Darren. Let me build on that and just give an illustration. There's a set of field study programs that Martin knows quite a bit about because it's actually administered through science. I participate in one, and one aspect of this African field study program is that it actually visits the research sites of a number of the profs where they have been carrying on ongoing research, and students are able to read and then engage in the research activities for the place, and that's in small, relatively small numbers. So they're able to have that sort of hands-on, and many of them, that turns out to be the formative experience in their professional directions. Any other comments? Our time is about up. I don't know if anybody has a last statement, but let me thank the panel for some stimulating comments that I think covered the ground. Thank you very much.